This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well.
I am Mary Hines, bringing the improvisational prowess, and I'm joined by my fabulous co-host.
This is Mark Linsenmeyer, supposedly bringing some philosophical thinking to the day, and we are joined by a very special guest.
Jerome Kurtenbach. I am a writer, composer, director, and coming to participate in this lovely podcast.
Woohoo!
Well, thank you for doing that. So Mary contacted you because we haven't actually talked about musical improv on this show. Whether we could actually do any musical improv, we certainly can't do it in the way that you're used to doing it, because you're like, you don't just sing and, you know, improv verses. This is not improvised Shakespeare, right? You actually do improvised musical accompaniment to other people improvising.
Usually, yeah. And what's challenging in rooms like this on Zoom or any virtual stage is the syncing of things. A lot of people fall out of sync. So it kind of has evolved more into either just singing without any accompaniment, or a lot of people preparing the pre-filmed content to make that happen. So it's no longer very much improv, but musical improv online can be a challenge because of that one factor alone. So it's possible, just not easy.
Mary, what have you done in this area? I know you sing, but are the two areas coordinated?
So I'm a trained singer, and I've done a good bit of musical improv, and I've worked with Jerome a lot over the last couple of years when the Second City, when the pandemic happened and we were all squirreled away in our, your sister's basement or like your mom's guest room, et cetera. And that's where I met Jerome, and we did a lot of virtual production, figuring out how to move that very like in-person art form, especially with the element of music online. So Zoom is really not friendly to it, but we forced her to be friendly and play nice in the sandbox. So it's been really fun working with Jerome, really figuring out these standards and how to move it to an online platform. And I love working with musical accompaniment. I have a group that I perform with in LA right now called Space Heater Improv. And normally another group that we perform with has musical accompaniment. And I always love it because it's such a character and sets the tone. But the group that I perform with is always scared of it. And so I always want musical accompaniment, and they're scared of it, which is fascinating to me because one of the core foundations of improvisation is feel the fear and do it anyway. Like that thing that scares you, that's the big fat yes.
So just to round it out, my experience in this area, I do a lot of songwriting. When you're writing a song, when you're doing anything creative, the first time you do it, you're improvising. So it's really just a matter of like how fancy you want to get. Mm-hmm. Are you actually going to do that on stage? I'm not like a great guitar soloist or anything like that. I could do some vocal soloing or whatever, but like generally I'm not a huge fan of jam band kind of stuff. Maybe I'm just not good enough to do that, but I do a lot of in my daily life. I feel like constantly improvising little songs, little jokes, especially surrounding the pets. So many, because then you can just, the lyrics are right there about what a good boy the dog is, the cat is, how much they add to society. And you just play with melodies.
100%.
Well, and I catch myself all the time over the years, because I've been improvising since I was a kid, coming up with ditties for mundane tasks in the world. So it could be as intimate as things that happen every day, or as random as things that happen around your day, whether it's going to drive somewhere, and you just come up with little ditties. And I think that's the cool thing about improv itself, is that you can use it in multiple spaces, and it doesn't always have to be song either, but when it is, it creates another layer of, I call it excitement, because it allows people to hear the information differently.
So Jerome, how did you get into musical improv? How did that start for you?
Well, as I just alluded to, when I was very, very young, like age 8 young, I started playing on the piano, and I just kind of started making things up, like all the time. And then what that parlayed into was me actually wanting to repeat what I heard other people doing, whether it was on a pop song or whatever, or hearing people singing in whatever environment it was. And I'd go to try to repeat it. So both my improv skills and my like wanting to repeat something was being built foundationally from the very beginning, like as a young kid. So then as I became an adult, I started working in sketch comedy and improv comedy, and it really sparked all those intuitive things that I was already applying as a pianist all the time, because piano is my main instrument. But that skill was just that play that I really, really started to investigate. And what's interesting about the play, that's also how I got into becoming a composer. So, and I'm not just talking about the songwriting element, like when I started to actually write for orchestra and all that stuff, there's still an element of improv that comes through. Like you, Mark, I don't know if I would always label it as improv when you're improvising something new. Because for me, when I'm starting something new creatively, I'm already filling in the gaps of, like, you know, when you're in improv, what's the prompt? What's the brief? What's the suggestion? So I think I already skip a lot of steps when I'm actually starting to create that music, when it's going to be actually produced or written down or whatever it's going to be. There's that really quick jump from improv into actually writing down on paper. So I think there's an element of something that from when I was a child to this adulthood version of me where I'm improvising every week, because I still perform improv every week for a kid show that actually started at the Second City and now is in a different theater. But that sense of play always keeps me going and figuring out what is going to be that. Even a show that I keep doing over and over and over again, I still have to think what is supporting the scene, what's interesting, what might be funny, what might be commenting on a moment, you know, because what I'm doing is not always to be sung. It's also supporting scene work. And it doesn't mean the scene work is dramatic or funny. It could be any of those things. It could be funny. It could be silly. It could be really intense or serious. So I got to keep, it feels like I'm playing a silent movie sometimes as an improviser when I'm at the piano. So it's very much that world. And I feel like it's been from the beginning for me. So as a young little kid, that I feel like I'm still using those skills of just playing around and figuring out how to later on codify it. This is what this is. And this is what this means. And this is what that is. And all those things. But what's wild is I think the two worlds have always existed for me. The improvisatory part, I went into jazz later on in like high school and college. And jazz has tons of improv. And then also the written down, very codified, very specific, very regimented version of musical elements and storytelling, including as a writer. There's all of that too. Like you brainstorm, and that's the improv of writing down a script. But then when you have to figure out how to actually write it down, you have to follow some of those rules. And so I think that lovely part about what improv is really made it interesting to keep both going all the time.
I'm so curious, when you're sitting at your keyboard and you're the MD for a show, how do you start? Like, what happens
the
in
MD,
your brain?
Is that what
that,
you
like,
said? Sorry.
MD is the okay. Is what we say in the biz for a musical director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And also doctor. I don't know.
I do surgery.
Yes, you do musical surgery. You save scenes with your scalpel. So you're at your keyboard as the MD, and what happens? Like, what's the step-by-step process of what happens as you're like seeing a scene? Like, do you just like jump into it and figure it out along the way? But like, tell us more. How's it work? How's the sausage made?
I mean, so the interesting thing about that question alone is there's two parts to it. So the first part is, does the scene need support from the top of the scene? Like, is the musical element that I'm adding vital at the beginning? Or is it something where I have to also investigate what the characters on stage are creating? So meaning like, okay, there's these actors. I don't know if it's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 or whatever. I also have to learn in the process that you're asking what I'm seeing, and I have to interpret it live. So it's like, you have to really investigate while you're sitting there at the keyboard, like, okay, when is the most important time to come in as a pianist / MD? But more importantly, is it vital? So there's moments where I have to also sit back and not play, and also really pay attention to the narrative that's being created live in an improv moment. So what inspires the music to start is the same thing as if you were writing a musical or if you were scoring a film, which I do all of those things already too. So it's the idea of like, what does that moment, that element of artistic creation do to the scene? What does it bring to the scene? What does it add to the scene? And that really, to me, is the cool thing about it, where I get to see, oh, these characters they're not saying much yet, but when something maybe more seemingly important is said or done, it could be an action too. The music could also help shine a light on it and comment on it in a way that isn't detracting, but more like, hey, audience, pay attention to that, you know, similar to what they do with film scores and musical theater and or opera. So it really calls attention to parts of the narrative that you hope the audience can feel enveloped in that moment rather than like taken out of it because, oh, there's a piano over there doing a thing.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And I think this is where it also links up to philosophy is having that moment of discernment, like, am I helping here or am I vomiting my expertise all over you? So I'm curious, Mark, how does that relate to how you share the philosophical know-how? Like, you know, does that go through the mind of a philosopher in those conversations? Or like, is what I'm about to share of benefit? Or is it for me? Or is it for us in the ensemble?
I mean, that's been an issue, especially on this show, when I have to worry about, is it, you know, is it obnoxious to bring in some figure? I know some about some ancient Greek musical theater, but I don't know enough to say how the chorus, you know, I don't actually have a relevant point from my storehouse to exactly what we're talking about here. But of course, the idea of fittingness and the idea of flexibility and the idea of openness to, yeah, finding something that actually fits in the moment. When you hit a certain point and you're not sure what to say, you cannot help but sing. So it seems like if you don't know what you're accompanying a scene, then you're just like, I don't even know what to do. I'll just grab the mic. I'll just dominate the scene. I'll just push them off the stage and change the show entirely. Presumably you don't do that.
New employees, welcome to Doggy Days Daycare. We're so excited to have both of you as our newest employees at Doggy Days Daycare. And the final, this is actually the final stage in the interview. I'm going to present some good boys and girls to you. And I want to hear what song you would have for them. Sounds good? Okay, so here, bring in Dinah. Okay, so this is Dinah. Dinah is one of our oldest dogs. We don't really know how big her body is because she is so furry. It is not safe to make direct eye contact, and you can only pet her when she's given you permission. What have you got? Just a little ditty. What do you got?
I just need some clarification. Will she blow her horn? Because I don't want to suggest that she blow her horn if she's not going to actually blow her horn. You see my issue. I there seem to be some ground rules.
I do see your issue, but I don't know. Maybe you should ask her.
I mean, what are the ramifications if Dinah blows her horn?
Ah.
I mean, that could be a conundrum. Like, you know, the horn is blown. What do we learn from
she
that?
She might poop everywhere.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
If any horns are blown near her, it's projectile poop. And, you know, it happens. Sometimes you got the grumbly tumbly and poop's got to come out whether it's ready or not. Okay, so we'll put Dinah down.
Okay. All right, honey, go ahead.
Our next dog is Princess. Princess is a Doberman. Princess is very, very intelligent. Actually, a little bit more intelligent than we would like for her to be. She constantly needs problem solving, enrichment, and she's a very clever girl. What do you think?
Princess, do you think that there should be a monarchy at this point still? Do you think that dogs should be at the head of the monarchy at this point still? Do you think that maybe there should be some sort of election to decide who is the head, or are you a princess in name only? Something like that.
Well, she's actually Norwegian in descent. And so she's actually really, really promoting the monarchy at the moment. But that's great. Steven, do you have any ideas?
I mean, if the monarchy is already established, then we've got very much a kingdom to talk about here. Is she the queen? Is she a king?
She thinks she is. Yeah.
She could be both. The sole monarch.
Does she have to marry a...
I'm saying I don't even think there has to be a marriage in this monarchy. I think it can be just a solo run monarchy.
It's just if you become promoted, how does a princess become a queen?
How does a princess become a queen? Does she do it by being mean? You can be a bitch if you want, or you could be really nice.
But in the case of a dog, you already have to talk about the realistic parts about being a bitch, because that's just a name, not a quality.
And scene. Great.
And scene.
Great. We got to bitch, and that's really all I wanted.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted all along.
To me, where those moments like that where you have double entendres. I love that in all of comedy anyway, where you can play with wordplay.
It's so fun.
That is so fun. Especially when you're talking about a dog, you can be literal and proverbial. And that's so, it's where some of the gold is.
Mm-hmm.
Happens a lot in a lot of scenes.
This episode is also sponsored by Squarespace, a quick and easy way to get a premium website with all the tools you need to claim your domain, showcase your offerings, grow your brand, and get paid. This is a service that I really wish had been around when I was starting my various websites. I remember how difficult it was to figure out a color scheme, a font. I'm not that great with colors. Well, Squarespace has professionally designed and award-winning website templates, plus the new Blueprint AI, which will give you a fully custom website in just a few steps using basic information about your industry, your goals, your style. I have tried this. It comes up with really interesting design recommendations. You can have it generate premium quality content, right? So product descriptions, visual design effects, interesting ways to list what you offer. You don't have to have experience with any of this. And once you got your website, which could have videos, it could have a store, it could have a place where people can donate money. All problems that I faced and mostly failed to solve when I was designing my initial websites back in the 90s. Squarespace automatically optimizes the website to be indexed with meta descriptions, an auto-generated sitemap, the SEO tools, which will help you show up more often on search engines, get more eyes on your site. And they've got great analytics, so you can see what eyes have been on your site. Squarespace has tools for email campaigns, so you can get more eyes on your site. You really should check this out. Head to squarespace.com/Linsenmayer, that's my last name, Linsenmayer, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain using code Linsenmayer.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for university, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's football team? Or raise funds for a small business, a charity, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now. Who could use your help? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
What are your favorite projects to work on? I know you have such like a diverse, like with composing, et cetera. I know something that I really love from working with Jerome on our virtual Second City shows. You've really created a new standard by doing a really awesome all ensemble music video, but it's all done through Zoom. So everyone films their own individual pieces and then it comes together and it's really dazzling and it's really exciting and pushes the boundaries of how we're all gathering through our technology portals to do a very in-person art form.
Again, what's most interesting about that is I just kind of landed on that concept because of what happened through the pandemic. But prior to that, for context, I have been directing since post-college film and writing film. So when the pandemic hit, I was like, what can I do now that we have this thing called Zoom, which before Zoom was like Skype. That's kind of what everybody was familiar with.
Yeah, correct.
And so then we got to this thing called Zoom. We all had to learn what that meant, what the word Zoom was. I'm like, are we talking about Mazda? Or are we talking about a thing here? You know, Zoom. So I was like,
great. Zoom.
It's a new app that we're using to video interface with people, which is like FaceTime or something else. And then I was like, okay, how are we going to do comedy, improv comedy? Oh no, now we're going to be singing live. And then I was like, the parameters became so tight with what barriers were being erected by the technology that I was like, well, how can we use the technology in a new way that isn't really new, but perceive it differently? And then I kept thinking to myself, well, I already have the skills to edit because I've had to edit my own work. And then I also direct. So what if I just create a music video instead of having this like live capture version of something, which was lovely, but I had already experienced some of that on Zoom and it didn't play out as elegantly as I feel like a live broadcast for television does because all the elements aren't the same. live broadcast for television is all the technology is high end. And the amount of time things can go out is so rapid. And I had done that with recording like orchestras via different countries, and you have a much faster feed time. So what we checked on earlier with our delay, that delay gets down to like the millisecond. But when you're doing it live with all kinds of different people's technologies, and are they working on a phone, they're working on a laptop, they're working on a desktop, are they Wi-Fi, are they whatever? So it's like, what's going to be the easiest way to get through that? And to your question, I was like, the most favorite thing I love to do is put together, you know, stories via the format of video. It's film, television, whatever that is. And yes, I still do stage work. But this medium of creating art in this way, I was like, well, how can we parlay that in using Zoom as a mediary? So what I did, to Mary's point, is we said, okay, well, we used to do these songs live on stage, right? And perform them like a musical theater song. Well, in lieu of having a stage, what if we just create music videos? And because this records in the frame that you would use as a captured video content, what if we just have the actors record like they're in a recording studio and perform live to their cameras? And both of those things melded together. And so what I did was, once we had the song written and produced, the actors come in and record their parts. I'm there directing them and capturing it live on Zoom. And then I compile it together through an edit to make a short music video. And it was really something that changed the perspective. Even the head of Second City was like, how did you do that? And I'm like, we just record in Zoom like a recording studio. And then that's become, for me, the only way I will do it if I'm doing a musical portion that isn't improv for a show live on Zoom. So think of it like as an SNL recorded bit.
Yeah.
But that incorporates all of my skills. I don't do as much of the writing for this. I do more of the directing and editing and making the music happen. Yeah. And to your question, like someone asked me yesterday, what is the hierarchy for me? Mine is directing, writing, and composing at this stage in my career. So I love directing. I love writing. I love scoring, but that's the order of hierarchy for me. So that I get to do some of that here when I'm doing it on Zoom has been really, really fantastic. And yes, I did create that, and it's now becoming an actual class at Second City. So
yeah, it's just, I just think it's really neat. The work that you and I have done together, forging forward, feeling the fear and doing it anyway, surrendering and adapting without even allowing your ego to get in there, because there's no time to chunk through your ego and adapt and surrender at the same time. So Mark, I'm curious, Mark, what you got philosophy wise about adaptability and surrender under crisis? Who you got for us?
I mean, this is basically the same question you were asking before, and I feel like I had nothing. I feel like I just needed to break into song to say how sometimes you come in the morning with some idea of what you might want to relate, but then you're around other people and it's like they're speaking some other language, though not one that you hate. That's the only thing. Being able to actually rhyme in a song, but, you know, you just got to do it slow enough and then you can come up with a rhyme.
So are there any philosophers who have any relevant points on adaptability and surrender?
Surrender. Jeez.
I love that. You know, like, because I know that's such a tenet of improvisation. What does philosophy have that mirrors that?
Philosophy of surrender, I'm brought to sort of Christian stuff, which, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of, you know, surrender before God, but you could, pretty much any theological argument, you could make some sort of secular version of it. So something that is against the idea. In fact, right now I'm reading Hegel, who is very, not as politically liberal as you might think that somebody who thinks that he understands where the end of history is going. And that anytime you think that you are doing something individual, you are actually pulling from the zeitgeist.
Mm.
This is obviously means a lot to me when I'm thinking about coming up with melodies. Like, there is no such thing as a truly original melody. The fact that you're using a major scale or whatnot is completely a matter of things that have been pressed upon you. So it's all just, I don't want to say garbage in, garbage out, but what goes in is what goes out. So that even the idea of genius or something, I am very suspicious of. I mean, that's the ability to synthesize very rapidly. So if that's what that is, then actually computers should be able to do that pretty well. But we don't think computers can be creative. So that must not be what creativity amounts to.
I feel like creativity in this way, everything borrows from something. And I am an amalgam of all of my training and experience. I started learning piano when I was 5, and I learned piano Suzuki, which is by ear. And I learned theory as well. And then I was also trained vocally. In our house, there was always classical music playing on speaker systems throughout the entire house. Oh, I always, my parents always brought us to see the orchestra. They always enriched us. You know, it was always like Fraggle Rock, the Muppet Show. Anyway, so I'm looking back and I'm seeing everything that shaped and nourished me. And that is all available for me as an improviser to pull from at any moment in time. Mm-hmm. So my style is an amalgam of every single nourishing, nutrient-rich thing that I've imbibed over the years of being Mary Hines.
And what you're both saying is very interesting in the concepts of what creation looks like, right? In the philosophical vein of this conversation, in this modern world, we have had more access, including those of us who are born in the 70s and 80s. There was a big tidal shift on how we could access lots of information, including entertainment, art, all of that stuff. So you and I, and potentially you, Mark, too, were exposed to so much different stuff. We had a record player playing all kinds of different records, from pop music to orchestra to folk to opera to all these things, because we just had it. But then, you know, TV and all that stuff started adding more and more elements of creative things. And I also wonder what was happening to the composers, writers, poets, actors pre our current modern era. So if you think 400 years ago, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, these people were creating, even though they were borrowing from other people too. They've talked about like Brahms and Mozart, you know.
Yeah, they were all inspired by each other. They wrote symphonies that mirrored each other out of admiration.
So, and it happened through time. And so for me, it goes back to this, as clunky as it sounds, like even studying music history and how we as a species started creating music just on the musical world. I'm sure it's probably has a similar trajectory for like visual art, whether it's painting or sketching or whatever that is. But in the musical world, just alone creating came from mimicking.
Yeah.
So we were mimicking the world around us. We heard birds singing. We started to sing. And these are very rudimentary, generalized versions of everything that I'm saying. But the fascinating part about that is we were already starting to mimic. We were already starting to interpret with the tools that we had as the human beings that we were at the time, or the beings that we were pre-humanity. We were already mimicking things. So sounds we heard, rhythms we heard. So everything that we create musically is already foundationally derivative of something we heard in the wild, literally in the wild. Mm-hmm. So it's really fascinating to think, like you said, nothing's new under the sun. But what I do think is interesting about all of that, even when music was used as a tool to communicate story and your histories as just a history lesson, music was not always just art alone. It was used as a tool to communicate in a different way than spoken word. It was also a memory tool. Is there any part of that where the perspective of the singer and or communicator already shifts something because they bring their lived experience into their what they're... Mm-hmm. So when you think of the game telephone, right? Messages change over time. Mm-hmm. That's how music changes over time too. Like it might take an element from the past and it makes it new, or reinterprets it or reinvents it, and it becomes this very new thing. Just because it has elements of the past doesn't mean it isn't new and has its own unique worth in the present. But I'm saying that in so much that I feel like it is part of our nature from before we were codifying anything as a melody, a rhythm, a this, a that, or whatever. It was just like we heard a bird, so let's sing along with the bird, and we did. And that's when the voice became much more prominent as a tool for communication. Then it became art. And then art, you know, then we talk about the conversation about how many stories are there. There's 7 main stories in the world, right? How many melodies are there if you're using the major scale? What about all the modes? You know, like how many tunes can you write in the Dorian scale? There's all kinds of interpretations of like, what is derivative? What's not derivative? How much is, like you were saying, Mary, about like honoring the person you were hearing before in your past. So if you were like, oh, I'm writing a piece to pay homage to them, you know, so there's a lot of philosophy in all of that, because I think that's what, you know, gets to the nuts and bolts of what art is, what storytelling is, and all of the things I feel like I'm up to is just versions of storytelling. Whatever hat I'm wearing is telling parts of a story, or the whole story, or part of a story.
Surrender for me in my musical development from when I was a young person was to a great degree giving up the idea of art for art's sake, as opposed to art for communication. So what you were asking about, Mary, with the previous question that I whiffed, the context was, you know, there's an improv scene going on or something. You're there at your keyboard. How do you figure out what is the right thing to enter at that moment? So of course, there's a matter of style and uniqueness and self-expression and having it, but mostly you want to do something that is sensible as a form of communication in that particular circumstance. And so, right, I started actually in music composition school, and it was sort of, oh, that like Philip Glass, what a sellout. He was in composition school and then he said, I'm going to use my rock and roll riffs to come up with these soundtracks and make $1 million and things. And so the snooty people who are running the University of Michigan music school that were my composition teachers did not like that kind of thing. But I mean, I feel like that's a great model, what Philip Glass did in bringing together these worlds and actually making it accessible and actually being able to say something such that people are actually listening to his stuff, probably not so much listening to the kind of things that I was then showing up and watching in the theater as part of the music school, where it'd be this weird, you know, semitonal, you know, cutting edge thing that I just in some way gave up the whole idea of being cutting edge, at least in terms of actual use of notes. Like, yes, try to come up with a different tone. Tom Waits is a great example of someone who, instead of a snare drum, I'm just going to like throw a chair against a locker and that'll be my snare drum. Like, I love that kind of stuff because that's all in the realm of style and idiosyncrasy and not actually trying to cut any edges. There's no edges to cut.
Well, I think what you just pointed out to Mark, I had the exact same experience around, we had the same conversation around Philip Glass. There was a lot of conversation about, and it's unfortunate because then we literally look at like, how do we rate art, right? Like that's good art, that's bad art. Mm. That's not art, that's just this, or this is that, and this is that. And you're like, I had a colleague say something that to me was profound. I don't think they meant it to be profound, but in so much that the message he was conveying to singers was music never lies. And what's fascinating about that statement is he was trying to communicate that there's truth in whatever you're hearing. So if the accompaniment to something in an improv scene is saying something, it's saying something, whether you want it to or not. Even if it's wallpaper, that term that a lot of people throw about accompaniment, whether it's film scoring, like Philip Glass is notorious for having a lot of repetitive motion sounding in his scores, and some of his live material as well. But that's the nature of minimalistic approaches in composition itself. But then you have to think, even in the improvised world, like what you would do, Mary, anything any character does, anyone walking on, is it valid or not valid? It's telling a story. It's not going to lie about it. It's going to be what it is. And then it's up to the audience's ears to follow through of those moments to reveal what that truth actually is. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, okay, so I came up with this thing as an actor. Look at me being an actor and improvising. Well, there's another actor on stage doing the same thing. And then, oh, there's another musical element. All of it's still telling something. It's a story, whether we want it to be or not. It's up to the audience's ears and minds to interpret what they're witnessing. And you're still doing the thing alive on stage. But I think to your point about the Philip Glass story too, is that I also wanted to break the norms of what I'd heard before. And it brings it back to what we were saying earlier about how much do we repeat what we've heard? My biggest mantra as a composer, young composer, was I didn't want to write in 3-4 or 4-4 because I was so tired of playing 3-4 and 4-4 for most of my piano life, singing it in all the church things I ever did. And everything was so codified in these 2 meters. And you're like, I don't want to write like that. So I worked so hard to not write these things. But I realized later on that I was like, that was just an exercise for me. Not in futility, but for me to get into the mind of what I wanted to be as a composer, I say, but again, storyteller. And I think it all wraps up into these things of like Philip Glass's approach is just as valid as this person who has really extremely, quote, complex music, right? And I think that was an interesting thing to learn because it's the same thing I apply scoring something or supporting an actress like Mary on stage, where I would like, oh, I need to support the scene just like a storyteller is supporting the scene. It's not just about what music am I putting to the thing, right? And I do that composing wise. How does it to really, really add to and fill in more lines of that story that aren't there yet? And then that whole mantra of like, it never lies, it's still going to tell some truth. And you just have to be willing to say that's going to happen. A lot of students, especially in musical theater, like, why is the accompaniment so busy, but my notes are so like languid and I have to sing these long notes, but there's all this frenetic motion happening underneath me. And improvisers have the same experience. They're like, the music sounds so busy. And I'm like, because your character is emotionally feeling distraught. You're not speaking distraughtedly. You're not saying things, but we can tell the characters either anxious or something, or maybe you're pacing. That music is supporting the truth of what we see from the visual part of it. And I'm like, that's so interesting to me that it still rings true for all these elements, you know? And that's, Mark, all the way back to what you're saying about surrender. You have to be surrendered to those elements that all come together and coalesce in different ways. And that's the beauty of improv too. You don't know what's going to happen when. And that's what I think is the magic of, you know, putting that all together and having a show or a performance or a scene or whatever. And you get to put all these elements together. And it creates something, I think, that's where I think the uniqueness comes in.
Right. And I love these elements of art as communication and art as truth. And whenever I get the opportunity to work with an MD and work with music, I love it so much because they are another character to me. And I consider that music a character. And it's so valuable and fun to have that different point of view and to be able to incorporate that in the story that's unfurling and unfolding, because you don't have a script. Like, it's being written on your feet as you feel it and show it and speak it.
Well, I would like to welcome you both to this support group for people that sing all the time. I know it can be hard. I know people in your lives might think that it is an impediment for communication, that, for instance, everything you say has to rhyme.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm having a problem you all can see. I'm covered in shit of various creatures because they love my vocal features. How do I work through life attracting birds and poop in my life? It's a problem. It's a problem.
Some of that poop doesn't look like it came from a bird.
It's a problem. It's a problem.
Perhaps you could sit a little further away from the rest of the group. What about you, sir? You
I'm look a problem. Like,
yes, yes. You look like you are completely absent of shit.
Well, the biggest part of it is that you have to be willing to be absurd. In the moments that you don't understand, you just have to be willing to be heard. So play along and see where it goes.
Can I offer you one of my birds? I have too many, you see.
I'll have the third.
Okay. Off you go, my pretties.
Go forth. Can you sit a little further away for your scent?
I'm a problem.
I don't know. One of the problems that I've heard expressed by many people with our issue is that song always tells the truth. So what if you want to lie? Are you able to lie to your loved ones while you sing?
Well, I think there is the conundrum.
Conundrum. It's a problem.
It's a problem.
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 Problem. Sorry, not warmed up, a little flat.
And that's fun. Enough of that.
It is fun, but I think what you just posited is actually a really interesting question. It's like, well, how do you lie if everything is about the truth? And I think the interesting thing about that is subversion of expectation. That's where you get to play with the art form, right? And so you paint the picture as if one thing is something, but then you tell the other when that is revealed later. And I think that's where you bring the audience on a journey. So it's the same in like a script, like if there's a twist or whatever, music can have a twist too. You're like, oh, you thought this was happening this way, but then it happens this way. Because I think that's actually a real question. Like, how do you lie if it's telling the truth? And I think what it might be more clearly stated is it's telling the truth in the moment. And then the story has to reveal how much of that was true or not in the story that you're unfurling.
I mean, there's the obvious distinction between, can you tell the truth through fiction? Oh, yes, I'm telling a deeper human truth. I know this story did not exactly happen this way, but I'm revealing something about human nature. So can you intentionally, or sometimes you run into an art maybe done with all the best of intentions, but that is presenting a picture of human nature that you profoundly do not agree with. So a great example would be, what is the famous anti-marijuana film Reefer Madness?
That was made into a musical.
Yeah. Reefer Madness, Reefer Madness. Reefer Madness, Reefer Madness.
I've never actually seen the musical version of that, but I've
Oh, you must, Mark. Your homework. Yeah, it's really wild.
By people with a strong sense of irony, of course, but I think it was made entirely in earnest and presenting as a deep truth, a cautionary tale of how you can be, which there's something true about that. It could be a gateway drug, but not in the way that it is demonstrated. If people don't know the plot.
I feel like the musical was already self-aware that it wasn't for real. If I'm not mistaken, Mary, I think it was.
I agree. Yes. No, the musical was.
Yeah.
The musical was very aware of itself.
Campy.
Yeah.
It's kind of campy.
There's no very one. Campy. There's the very only reason campy. That film still exists is because of self-aware, playful.
Irreverent.
Yes. Nobody's actually showing their kids. Apparently, my sister said we were shown that in school, at least she was, as children.
Whoa.
And I don't think it was by Mystery Science Theater lovers. I think it was, this was the 70s.
Genuine. So. I love that Jerome and I had the same facial reaction. We're like, are you fucking kidding me?
I mean, I get it. That's very propaganda-y, like in sex ed, where you have to show these specific videos to prevent things. But I'm like, okay. I think that's interesting too, that truth and lie, art can still be part of the communication of truths and lies. I think that's what's challenging too in culture is how to discern. And that's where we have those reality checks.
I have a question as we start to like round it out. What wisdom or advice, Jerome and Mark as well, would you have for people who want to bring more play and whimsy into their everyday? So it's like, I can see how something like this can be intimidating to people. And they're like, oh my gosh, like I'm not going to start good at that. So I'm not even going to try. So how do you start exploring musical elements into your everyday?
Well, I think it's the same thing I try to communicate to all new students, whether it's adults or children. First, know that everything you did as a kid was play, right? So you were like, if you're making up characters or playing with your friends and being, for us, it was cops and robbers. That was an old 70s, 80s thing. But in the modern vernacular, any characters that you create as a kid, think of those sensibilities and then they parlay all the way over into music, which they think is something different. And I try to communicate, again, it's all storytelling. It's just a different medium. I ask the question in a room with brand new improvisers when we're talking about just music. I'm like, how many of you sing in the car? Great. How many of you sing in the shower? How many of you sing sometimes when you do the dishes? And there's not always 100% hands raising, but I try to inspire these moments where they're already singing in their life, whether they
make
know
them
it or
aware.
Not,
yeah.
Of like, and yes, they could be singing songs they already know. That's fine. But they're being inspired to incorporate vocal stuff into their daily life. It could be doing cleaning, not just the dishes. It could be cleaning the house or dusting or whatever you do that's mundane. And that when you think about improv, you're already doing some of that in your life, whether it is labeled improv or not, right? Like you have a task to do. How you do that task might be exactly the same as you do it all the time because you might be meticulous, or it might be a little bit wiggly and different. That's where the play comes in, where you can actually think of that when you're creating something too, in like an improv moment or in a musical improv moment. Just come in with that a sense of like, oh yeah, I have this thing I might do, but I might not. So let me just see how it goes. And the see how it goes is where I feel like the play really starts to happen for people. And not judge yourself, that judgment. For me, musical improv has always been mired in judgment. There's like, my voice sounds like this. I don't know what music is. I don't know the terms you're telling me. I don't know how the rules are. And I always say, like, don't worry about the rules. Just start singing some things. I don't care how good or bad your voice sounds to you, because it's all great to me. And that isn't just some pie in the sky, like pacifistic approach to teaching it. It's more like, no, just have fun. And like I'm talking to you right now, do it with singing. And I think that helps a lot of people somewhat get out of their heads and think it's some of this lofty thing over here. Because it is challenging to think once you start adding some of the barriers that we have to do, like what's a chorus and what's a verse and what's a bridge. And
like the filters, right? Yeah.
All that stuff.
Conventions.
But I'm like, I always try to tell them, I'm like, it's just like the walls in your house. You're not vacuuming the entire apartment building. You're just vacuuming your apartment or your house. You're not going into the neighbor's house and vacuuming their house. Those are the constraints you have. You work in your constraints. And those are there to be tools to help tell your story. Just like your house is there to tell, allow you to live and be what you want it to be for you. So that you can do the same thing as an actor, as a singer, as a whatever you're going to do to tell a story improvisatorially. You really get that. If you can access that element of it, that's where the play comes in.
I want to leave people with an exercise because this has made me realize I can't really get my family, for instance, to improv with me. If I just try to do a bit, they just like, they might react to the bit or, you know, but they're not going to like become a character themselves. If I'm like, hey man, got a cigarette. Like if I start like that, I'm not going to start something with one of my kids that way. I didn't start them early enough on it. But if I do it musically, did you remember to take out the garbage? Like there's a good chance that I can get a musical response out of that and can keep that going. So I try it with the people in your life. Try both approaches. See what they respond to.
And still always take stock of where you are singing in your life. And that doesn't mean singing has to be the only thing. Mary, you were playing the piano. Mark, you probably played multiple instruments. So it's just like, take stock of some of that, because that does matter to when you're going to do something improvisatorially. Don't let all that just go away because, oh, no, now I have to improvise on site, you know?
Well, thank you so much, Jerome, for telling us a little about your very, very impressive body of work. Where would you like folks to look you up?
The easiest way is to go to my website, which is jeromegrinbach.com. That is the one-stop shop for now. I do have some social media presence, but I don't access it very often. So website is where you're going to find
me. We were listening through your tunes before you showed up.
Oh, yay. Fun. I'm glad it was there.
Any final words of wisdom, Mary?
I'd say hopefully, listeners, you're able to incorporate more like music and play and curiosity into your day. I find now more than ever, I almost always, my favorite, a little plug here for 98.7 WFMT Chicago, the Chicago's classical music station. They have a streaming app. And because I love Chicago and I miss Chicago, I pretty much always have 98.7 WFMT playing. And they have so many cool different programs of music. And there's something about having music on in the background that helps me think. Like it's very relaxing and soothing to me. Now I just love music. And I think it's such a fascinating friend to keep with us on our journey and keep us grounded and curious and playful.
Hopefully, if you're not listening just to Schoenberg's 12-tone, that's not a good way to spend your day. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can get more at philosophyimprov.com. Typically record some post-game chatting, and in this case, our guest Jerome stuck around for it. Normally, this is reserved for philosophy versus improv supporters. So if you want to hear this kind of thing for most of the episodes, go to patreon.com/philosophyimprov. But I'm going to go ahead and present it here. Because we had some fun, got into some interesting territory. Were you a PVI supporter, you could hear all content of this sort. So enjoy this free sample after the ads that you can fast forward through. In addition to the post-game chatting, our supporter feeds are entirely ad-free. So if you like this show and never want to hear ads on it again, the place to go is patreon.com/philosophyimprov. Hey, now we're in the supporter-only post-game. I don't know if improv or philosophy won. This was a very different whole realm, but I definitely learned a lot about the specific things that you do, Jerome, and was sorry we could not technologically make it happen to be able to have you tickle the ivories along with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also interesting for your audience and listeners. I think the thing that Mary and I have learned kind of the hard way is that when you have live singing and keyboards from two different locations, the lag doesn't allow the audience to stay with you. So it gets a little dicey for communicating anything. It's kind of a mishmash, and it didn't quite elegantly land. If Zoom were really powerful and we could get rid of the lag for all users, including the viewers, because it changes for each viewer too, that's where it got really dicey to have live improvised musical elements in a Zoom room and or other technologies, unless you're already with the big companies that you do record giant orchestras via different countries. You just have to have really fast internet and really fast interfaces that allow that to happen. So I just support scenes rather than they sing with me. So it's more of I'm just improvising behind scene work, and it's never sung to live on Zoom. So that's, I'm like, it's great. But for something like this, it was interesting to say, you know, it would only just be me accompanying a scene, not actual singing. Yeah, I think that was the limits of the technology.
Can I suggest for the audience, given our terrible lag right now, that we all try to sing Happy Birthday together. And when you hear that somebody else is behind you, adjust yourself to try to sing in unison with them. And then when we all do, and let's just see whether we can get through the whole song.
Is this for my birthday? Thank you. Thank you.
One, two, three. Happy birthday,
to you.
Happy
birthday to you.
So I found
you're welcome, everybody.
You're welcome.
It's especially hard to try to sync yourself to two different people who are not in sync. That I was mostly paying attention to Jerome, but then I noticed, oh, Mary's way behind us. So let me try to match her. And so that's why we don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. And fun fact about Happy Birthday, I'm going to go on a tangent. It's not a dirge, but I don't know why society made it into a dirge. Why is it a dirge, everybody?
To you, happy birthday to you.
No, actually, Mark, I've been inspiring people that it's actually more like a waltz in one. So, ba ba da bum bum bum, ba ba da bum bum bum, ya ba da ba 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 da, ya ba da bum bum bum. Why isn't it that fast for everybody?
Yeah.
Marilyn Monroe is not the standard for how slow we should sing happy birthday to anybody in the world.
Because then it's
so
like...
anyway, I just...
Oh, God damn. We got to do this song. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Okay. Yeah, all right. Just blow the fucking candles out.
But that's what, from my experience from... So I sang in the church choir from like age 12. I sang in choirs my whole life. I was the cantor. I was the soloist. I was that soprano, right?
Same.
And I love, right? Of course, that's one of the reasons why we're friends, because same lineage. And I remember, and it used to like drive our conductor like absolutely crazy, because people want to make it dirgy. Like, they want to make it slow. And he was an amazing, you know, musician, and he would bring some really cool pieces in for us to sing. And as the choir, like, we had zip and pep because we were trained, but like any of the stuff involving the congregation, it's like, and it still drives me crazy when I go to church to this day. I'm like, everybody, why are we dragging this through the mud? Like, why are we going so slow and dirgy, guys?
I will say, as another tangent, when I used to be a church musician, I was known for keeping the hymns at a good clip.
Chop.
Let's go. Even if I was on the organ, because I played the organ for many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
So if I wasn't on the piano, I was playing on an organ. I remember having conversations with the pastors over the years that I'm like, no, these tunes aren't all meant to be slow. There's a few that are, but not every tune in all of church music.
It's a celebration, goddammit.
Well, I don't mind if it becomes big and huge and whatever, if it's for like a big holiday or whatever. That's cool if something that might otherwise be a little bit faster gets a little bit more pomp and circumstance. But to your point, Mary, it was always like, why is this hymn so slow? It's not even a ballad. And now they're making this into a ballad. Anyway, which is fascinating because like things like Sister Act, where you get these like really fast versions of these old,
hallelujah.
And you're like, oh yeah, they could actually be that fast in real life outside of this film. So, you know, what are we doing? But in sync on Zoom, that still doesn't matter what temple you're in.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, everybody. Actually, yes, it is my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Are we celebrating my birthday?
Is it today your birthday?
No, it's a week from today. So,
okay, well,
1 week later.
It's the season of your solar return.
It's the season. Yeah. Mark, great demonstration of out of sync performing on Zoom.
I love
through
that
the happy birthday song.
I was terrified to do it. I was terrified.
I will provide folks the link to this. I'm sending you the link to this. I will just tell you. So I recorded, speaking of these dirges, a dirge version of the 12 Days of Christmas, where I did the whole thing like in an opera voice. And it is and I had to put it on verse by verse, and each verse would be longer than the previous one. So and then I had different bands, other musicians come and jam over the different. So I'd like give one band verse 3 and one band verse 4. And so the whole thing is an hour long. And this sort of shows you what I think of the avant-garde, because it is so silly.
Wow.
But there are parts of it that I actually enjoy. Like, I got a stand-up comedian.
I mean, is it like a Charles Ives and you have two songs happening at the same time happening here? What's going on?
Because it's got sort of the drone thing that I'm doing, which once I'm singing a certain degree of, and I actually sang it all, like not necessarily all in a row, but like it's not electronically slowed down. But once that's there, it just becomes sort of a drone that then people could do things over, and each of them had their own different interpretation. One guy who's actually a co-host of one of my other podcasts, he had a verse and he like did his own little folk song over it, where he's doing a separate song completely. We made verse 12 into a Miles Davis-esque jazz jam. And I did drums through the whole thing and got a friend of mine to lay keyboard down, and it just becomes this whole, so it's not super dissonant. But this is also, I mean, you mentioned improvising versus writing something down, whereas it seems if you're writing something down but not stopping to think about it, isn't that a form of improvisation? It's just improvisation to your hand.
That's interesting you ask that. So, because people have asked me over the years all the time, like the biggest question is, how do you write? Like, how does the music come to you? Where does the music come from? To a certain extent, yes, it's whatever I've lived through in my entire lived experience at this point in my life. But I was challenged in college to hear the music first. So when you say, what do you write? How do you're improvising? I'm actually hearing it first, and then I'm just writing it down. So I'm hearing it in my head. So the reason why that's important is that I'm a pianist, right? We've talked about this earlier. I'm a pianist, but I thought when you compose music, you just sit at a piano and compose music, and then you figure out the rest later. And my mentor at the time was literally saying, how long did it, I wrote a song, short story. I wrote a song cycle as one of my first big pieces in composition. So ironically, a song cycle with a voice and piano. So incorporating all these worlds of song and music. And he asked, how long did it take you to write this? And I said, I don't know, about 6 to 9 months. I don't remember when I first started it. I think you would said, start thinking about what you want for the end of the year. And he's like, and how did you do it? And I said, well, I thought you go into the practice room and then you sit at a piano and you write the stuff down from note to note to note to note. Right? Like we do as improvisers. We just start and we go and we write it down. He's like, to your point, Mark, this is where I learned where the veering off of improvising into writing, I needed to crack that egg in a different way. He said, the next piece you write, I don't care what it's for, what instrument, person, voice, otherwise, you can't sit at the piano. You have to hear the whole piece in your head. Then he also expounded, it's, by the way, this is like John Corigliano, the tree of people. I'm the same method, John Corigliano, who's a composer and a film composer, all that stuff. Anyway, a big thing about that was like, you need to know what the whole piece is before you start writing it. And that takes you hearing the whole piece in your head. So it's not writing the whole piece in your head. You need to hear the whole piece in your head. And I'm like, oh, that was an interesting concept. And then when it got down to like, well, how do you write without having the instrument in your hands, like playing it? And then I could start, and I started writing on score paper what I heard. I didn't have the exact notes, the exact rhythms, but I had this sketching. And he was like, you can sketch out an entire piece of music, even if it's a 15-minute work on a piece of paper. And I was like, how do you do that? And he's like, it needs to look like a rendering of art. And I'm like, what? And so I started doing that. I don't use those tools anymore like that. But that broke my mind of like this whole idea that, well, you just write and you go and you just improvise and you keep writing and whatever comes out is what you do. Because then I had to learn the edit of all that. And how do you make sense of all that in your head? Because the key was, how are you going to write for a piccolo? How are you going to write for a tuba and you don't play these instruments? How are you going to write for the organ? Oh yeah, I play that instrument. So I knew what to do with that. But all these other things that you're going to be writing for in your career, in your mind, how do you write for it without playing it? So I was like, oh, that's a whole new crack of egg, where the improvising still came in as like, I can hear the tune in my head. And now I hear it on the instrument in my head. How do I write it down? Well, I know the rules of the instrument, so I could actually categorize those notes and pitches and all that stuff and what dynamics they're allowed to play, because the instruments only have so much room, right? So not all instruments can be really loud or really soft, you know, knowing those rules. And to your point, I actually was the experimental composer who wanted to throw a trash can around the room and make that percussion. And, you know, I was doing found objects as percussion all the time. I was a percussionist in college too, but it was just like, that part of play still came back in, like, oh, I just need to hear this stuff in my head and not worry so much about the written notes all the time. And then what he said the piano was used for most composers, including like Mozart and Beethoven and all these people, was like a check of what they're hearing.
Interesting.
You're pointing out that one could use this without being, right, the objective geniuses are like Mozart as depicted in Amadeus, where, oh, I have the whole thing written in my head. It's just a matter of actually writing it down. But I like this idea that, like, well, you could sort of map it out dramatically, that I'm going to start, here's the okay. And then, you know, when I want it to grow and I want it to about by 5 minutes, I wanted this thundering thing, that you could sort of match out, like you're just mapping out the drama of a play or something like that, you know, before you actually go then to write it scene by scene. So I like that idea of sort of storyboarding a piece of music.
It kind of was, but to your point about even storyboards, we're following some constraints that we've had over the centuries, mm-hmm. right? Of what a storyboard should be. Or Mary, especially if you've been in improv scenes a lot, there's a lot of like, these are the flow of things. Like you start it this way and then this happens and then this, there's like this out, like, kind of broad strokes outline of what...
It's like a skeletal structure.
Yeah. That once you break that rule and there's another player you're on stage with and they're like, I don't know where we are now, if you've now subverted an expectation of where the scene might go, that's where you have to continue to keep playing. But I think the idea of these outlines, you know, vague or more specific, allowed me to just start creating much more freely. Because just like we say about rules... I don't always think of rules as interpreting as blockades. I sometimes think of them as guides, as opposed to like, you can't do this or you must do that. It's more like, oh, I get to do blank because I don't have to worry about all the other things it could be. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, just like an improv, you're like, well, you have an entire open stage. It could be anything you want. But once you start making choices, just stay with the choices you're making and make new ones based on what you're...
Narrows the field.
Yes, because everyone's so intimidated by the whole thing. I'm like, yeah, that's intimidating. But then when you get it down into the scene that you're building with your player or yourself, if you're doing a solo scene, you find your groove and you find your path. It doesn't mean the whole world is just existing and you're just lost in all of it. You get into the narrow part of it. And that, to me, is the same thing that's happening when you're writing music, improvising music. And then that parlayed all the way over into writing scene, writing scripts and doing the actual job of writing down, you know, what people might say as characters. It's like, oh, now I know how that also works because of these other skills I've been implementing in storytelling and other elements in other genres. And that sense of play still comes into those building those scenes and structures that we all code later. Like, oh, this is, you know, the 11 o'clock number of a musical, you know? Well, yeah, but also the narrative built to that anyway. So whether it's called the 11 o'clock number or not, it doesn't matter. It still works as this piece. I just think that it was fascinating that you have to figure out how to navigate the writing, even though you're improvising at some point in the part of it. And by the way, I improvise after the outline is already built. Then that's where I get to play with like some improvisatory moments. Or like, okay, so yeah, it's going to be, like you said earlier, bombastic or something here in the middle. And like, what does that bombast actually sound like? Then you just play around like how bombastic is bombastic in this piece.
Sure.
So I think that's where the fun part of like putting these two worlds together, because they have been diametrically opposed really strict writing down and not writing anything down. I was like, how do you marry those worlds together?
So fascinating. Such great insights. Thanks so much, Jerome.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's probably good enough for the supporters. Thanks, supporters.
Yay. Thanks, supporters.
Thanks, everyone. I shall sell my soul. Bankrupt. 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 Bankrupt.